Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. I'm having a little trouble getting a hold of my guest, not answering in Great Britain. So I'm in the process of getting this show going, which is going to be a really interesting show, and trying to get him associated directly with us. So I'm just in the process right now of sending him an alternative number to see if that will work. And right now I'm looking for the button to send. And the show today is going to be really interesting because I've never seen anything like this done before. I'm going to be spending the next several weeks doing interviews with individuals who are authors in a textbook. It's kind of a popular textbook. It's called The Sedated Society, The Causes and Harms of Our Psychiatric Drug Epidemic. And the editor I'm trying to get a hold of right now, I've been in communication with him quite a bit, is James Davies. And we're trying to ring him up from our studio, which the studio and PRN does as a way of saving money for people who are overseas, that I'm saving them money, the people I talk to are overseas. And I'm sorry that there's going to be some confusion and some delay, it looks like, as I try to figure out what in the world may have gotten wrong here. The book has a number of different marvelous human beings that you've already heard on this show. And we're going to have a special 1 hour with each one of them. It includes James Davies, Peter Goetsche, who is this amazing physician and author of books that just indict the pharmaceutical industry. Sammy Tamimi, who is from Great Britain, Peter's from Denmark, a wonderful child psychiatrist. Joanna Moncrief, wonderful psychiatrist from Great Britain. Also from Great Britain, Luke Montague, who is an individual who's been through the system. And then I have a chapter, and Robert Whitaker has a chapter. China Mills, who is a new person to me, is going to be talking about the politics behind psychiatry. And Peter Kinderman, a great researcher, will also be on. And if you kind of look through, if you go to my website and you look for him, if you look for each of these people, on the radio section of my website, you'll see that most of them have been on my show. Some of them many times, like Joanna Moncrief and Peter Goetsche and Bob Whitaker. So this is a good book, and I decided to honor the book and our work by having these folks participate in a long number of activities, a long number of hours for each chapter. All right. We still haven't been able to locate him. And what I'm going to do if I can't locate him is talk about my chapter, which is on tardive dyskinesia, that dreadful, dreadful, dreadful disorder that is caused by all of the psychiatric drugs that we call antipsychotic drugs, medical bipolar drugs, many that now are being masqueraded as antidepressants. I'm just checking my email now to see if Jim has gotten back to me, but he's not. So I just don't know. Maybe he's gotten off on the time schedule, and I'll just stay alert and see if he does eventually find a way to get in touch with us. I think I'll do one more step while we're looking at this and send him the direct line to the studio. So just bear with me for a minute. I'm going to send him a direct studio line. And see if that will get through to him. All right. What is tardive dyskinesia? On the surface, the immediate way of describing it is that it's an abnormal movement disorder caused by I've got a new message here that I'm going to send him from my group of people. They're suggesting a new phone number at which to call him. And I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to just focus on tardive dyskinesia and sit back and see what happens. I'm telling him to try this number. You're in the middle of all this. Okay, I've given him an alternative number. And now I think all I can do is sit back and talk with you until my engineer instant messages me that perhaps he has joined us. He'll be disappointed because this is his book, Sedated Society, and it's a really, really good academic but readable by anyone kind of a book. So tardive dyskinesia is very, very interesting in that all of the symptoms of tardive dyskinesia are produced by, and this is going to be a little hard to believe, they are one and all of them produced by a disease called lethargic encephalitis. So in 1954, when the first of these drugs was discovered, which was chlorpromazine, thorazine, which is still in use, right away people began to notice that people given the drug, first they became very apathetic and they became very easy to handle. They became like merchandise instead of people. And the early authors, DeLay and Denneker, said very proudly that they knew right away just how wonderful this drug was because the nurses and aides were so pleased with the effect on the patients. And they said that's a kind of litmus test for whether a drug's working if the aides and nurses are pleased. Now, I think that everything should have stopped at that point. And psychiatry should have self-examined. What does it mean when the litmus test is that the nurses and the aides are pleased? It means, of course, that the people are easier to handle, less troublesome, and maybe less troublesome to themselves on the surface so that they don't scream and get angry and show pain, which, of course, even to the most jaded nurses and aides is going to be disturbing. So anything that's going to flatten the emotions and the behavior will do this. They all began to notice very early that the drug produced a Parkinsonism, which made it the patients inexpressive, made it difficult for them to move, that acted like what we might think of as a pharmacological straitjacket. And so they began debating whether the Parkinsonism. This is all in the first few years, 1954 to say 58. They began openly discussing, well, maybe the Parkinsonism is the treatment. Maybe the disease we're giving them of Parkinsonism is the treatment. In their own minds, the good effect was being described as indifference, that it made the patients indifferent. And so the discussion began to center around, is indifference part and parcel of Parkinsonism, part and parcel of the drug treatment? Now, many, many drugs now were turning up in that first year. Many drugs that were producing the same effect, and they were testing them on monkeys, on chimps, which we don't do much of now for the FDA. We usually stick with rats, and maybe dogs or cats, because the nearer you get to chimps, the more you can see the horrible effects on human beings. And a lot of other drugs were coming up. And one of the drugs was a drug that would become an antipsychotic that's still used around the world called Compazine. And this drug was tried on, it's used mostly to treat nausea, and it was tried on soldiers who were on battleships or landing ships because they wanted to help them not get nauseous, because all the antipsychotic drugs suppress nausea and vomiting because they all interfere with dopamine neurotransmission, which is a major neurotransmitter system. It goes from the basal ganglia deep in the brain up into the frontal lobes of the brain, causing the indifference, which is a lobotomy-like effect. And the basal ganglia also are a center of movement control in themselves, so they cause abnormal movements. And dopamine also goes to the nausea center and activates that. And so along with all these, this package of indifference and Parkinsonism and movement problems, also you get anti-nausea. So they were trying it on soldiers. Now, here I'm going to kind of take you a little bit aside, and what I'm going to talk about is happening every day today. Well, they had already been noticing, the researchers, kind of weird other movements that weren't Parkinsonism. Some of the patients would move their arms and legs in funny ways, and some of them would jiggle around and dance around, almost the opposite of Parkinsonism. They get hyperactive. Some would get really, really anxious. Some got more disturbed. Some would get funny. They'd make funny faces. Now, since almost all these patients were women, and women they'd called mentally ill, they ignored this. They thought these were symptoms of hysteria. Hysteria comes from a Greek word for womb. That is, that these disorders emanated from the wombs of women. They were psychological or physiological, whatever, but they came from being a woman. All this, these crazy things they saw, these odd posturings, catatonic-like states, all these weird stuff. Well, having tried the drug on young male soldiers, the drug company, in astonishment, called DeLay and Denneker in about 56 maybe, and said to them, hey, we're getting a bunch of really weird movements in the young men that we were giving these drugs to that are so similar to the drugs we've given you as a psychiatric drug. And DeLay and Denneker thought about this, and it struck one of them, you know, if we stop thinking about it just being women and their weird movement, I remember something like this that was going on around World War I and shortly after, maybe up until the 1930s, I'd heard about this. It was a disease called lethargic encephalitis. And it produced everything we're producing with our drugs. It produced indifference, Parkinsonism, and then all this other stuff. And so I think it was DeLay of DeLay and Denneker who, but I'll check that out and let you know if that's incorrect. It's in you can find this in my book, Brain-Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, second edition. I talk about this. And also in some of the papers I've written, I've got a paper comparing lethargic encephalitis to the psychiatric drug effects of the antipsychotic drugs. And you can find that paper, just search lethargic encephalitis on Breggin.com. So one of them, I think it was DeLay, went back and looked at the early literature on lethargic encephalitis, the earlier literature. And he wrote, this is amazing. We're actually producing exactly all the symptoms of an inflammatory brain disease, an epidemic form that spread out of Europe and around the world. This was amazing. So what did they do? What did these great men that we should worship as heroes of psychopharmacology, these two men who were psychiatrists in Paris, who started the drug revolution, what did they do when they learned this? Did they write immediately a paper? Because then those days they could get papers published almost within a month or two, very, very quickly. They could start a conference anytime they wanted. They could write to people anytime they wanted. They could phone them anytime. Did they get in touch with all the colleagues and say, wait, stop. These drugs that we've written dozens of papers about, all of us, that are now by 1956, 57, being given to millions of people around the world, we now realize we're reproducing chemically lethargic encephalitis, also called von Economo's disease, also called epidemic encephalitis, a very heavily studied disorder because neurologists were absolutely fascinated by a disease that could produce virtually every known neurological movement disorder that they'd ever heard of and a few more. So there were conferences on it. They really were excited about this. They really, really were enthusiastic. So, no, they didn't do that. Did they call the drug company and say, hey, we figured it out. Thanks for telling us. We've looked it up. We're reproducing lethargic encephalitis with our drugs. We have to stop. We could produce a chemical epidemic around the world. Maybe we're doing it. We're just not paying attention. No, they didn't do that either. What did they do? What did good DeLay and good Deniker do? They called the company and they said, this is exciting. Would you find for us the most toxic, neurotoxic variation on these drugs that you have, the one that has caused the most neurological dysfunction in the monkeys? And would you send it to us because we want to try it on our patients? We think we can reproduce lethargic encephalitis in our patients. We're going to do it. I do not lie. Those of you who know what I go through in the courtroom, what I go through in people vetting my books and articles, you know I speak truth. They got from the company a drug that is now called Mejaptokus in Europe because it's still used there. It never got approved here. They got this drug and they gave it to their patients to study the progressive neurological deterioration and to compare it to lethargic encephalitis. That's what they did, folks. So by 1957, they're able to publish an article describing the experiments on these patients, driving them into states of heavy Parkinsonism, driving them into states of mutism and catatonia from the overwhelm of these drugs, and producing in them multiple disorders that we now know are almost always permanent. So you can be sure they knew they weren't going away. Lips smacking, tongue protruding, grimacing, as well as an odd variety of abnormal movements, all of it typical of tardive dyskinesia. That's what they did. They wrote about it. And their work began dovetailing that 57 publication by publications in the U.S. in places like the American Medical Association's Journal, the American Psychiatric Association Journal, showing very high percentage of patients getting these symptoms, which we now know are permanent in most patients. This is astonishing. Later on, DeLay and Denneker, in all of their lovely wisdom, they would write, "We might have anticipated that we could produce a chemical epidemic of lethargic encephalitis, and now we know that we have." They wrote, "We might have anticipated that these disorders would become permanent, like in lethargic encephalitis, and we now know that's true." It was so interesting to read through how the disease mimicked in every way lethargic encephalitis, the disease of the drugs. And yet the one thing they didn't want to face for several years was that since the symptoms from in lethargic encephalitis often became permanent, that they were going to be, obviously, and they knew it was from damaging even dopamine centers in the basal ganglia. They knew that already. They knew about the basal ganglia. But they didn't just make the jump immediately. Well, it's going to be permanent. They also knew that patients were getting permanent psychoses, permanent dementia, but they didn't think of them as permanent. And they still don't, even today, with a massive literature about that I was one of the originators of in my books and articles, my scientific articles, where I wrote about dementia, brain disorders caused by these drugs. They're still not recognized by the Psychiatric Association, still not recognized by the British equivalent, still can't get any conference opportunities, seminar opportunities at the big national meetings to talk about this, still not admitting everything they really knew then, that these drugs produce abnormal movements, Parkinsonism, which often became permanent with lethargic encephalitis and does not often become permanent, at least visibly, in drug patients, producing psychosis, which we now call tardive psychosis, dementia, which we call euphemistically now tardive dysmentia. All this, though, is in the literature, though. I've reviewed it many times, and examined it. And won't be accepted yet fully by the powers that be at the top of international medicine and psychiatry. So it all begins with causing an epidemic brain disease and calling it a cure. And in the early days, they talked about, well, do you have to cause a disease to cause a cure? Just like Walter Freeman, who wrote an editorial about shock treatment and lobotomy, saying that patient needs less brains, helps patient have less brains, less brain function. This was a subject. Now, of course, curing diseases. These are disease-specific drugs. It's a pack of nonsense. Any human being develops all of the stuff I'm talking today if given these drugs, regardless of race, creed, color, whatever, psychiatric diagnosis, whatever. They all get, if the drug doses are high enough, the indifference, the apathy, the catatonic-like symptoms of immobility and abnormal movements, and a huge percentage will get tardive dyskinesia. These are broad array. So now let's look at the various symptoms of tardive dyskinesia and their rates. Let's first look more at the rates. And again, I'm doing this off the top of my head. A little bit of it here or there might be inexact, But you can get the exact by looking at any one of my books, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, my book on Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, second edition. Make sure you get second edition. And you can get about tardive dyskinesia in this book, The Sedated Society by James Davies. All right, for ordinary folks, 25, 30-year-old people, regardless of your diagnosis, but you're in good health and you're given an antipsychotic drug, what are the odds you'll get some degree, more than minimal, tardive dyskinesia? It's 5 to 8% per year cumulative. And again, if you doubt me, you don't even have to go to my books. You can go to my free, not in my best interest maybe, but it's certainly in the interest of the world, go to my free resource center on my website, Bregan.com. It's called the Antipsychotic Drug and Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center. It's got well over 100, maybe 150, 175 articles. And you can go and you can search it and find the section that talks about rates. I've got a section on rates for children, rates for young adults, rates for older people. All the articles are there. This legacy for all of you, my legacy. I ain't going anywhere yet. Good health, but it's my legacy. I'll keep it updated. So what are the rates? 5 to 8% a year cumulative. This is an astonishing phenomena. That means by 3 years, you have rates in healthy people of 15 to 24, 5%. That's really, really astonishing. The rates, though, go up. They go up. They start really escalating at age 45. And then with the elderly, which is 55 through usually 65 or 70, they don't even include folks my age. For the so-called elderly, the rates get to be around 20 to 30% a year cumulative for tardive dyskinesia. That's for this weird variety of abnormal movements. Astronomical rates. We don't have such good studies for the rates in children, but I can tell you, and I've got whatever I have, I've put on the website in terms of studies, most of what I have. We know they're probably as high as they are for young adults. Now, this is just looking at the physical stuff that happens to these patients. Grimacing, grinding their teeth till they break, moving their feet until they wear out the soles of their feet, experiencing horrible, deforming, agonizing, twisting of the neck muscles and spasming of other muscles, which we call tardive dystonia. Tardive akathisia, in which there's such a horrible inner agitation. The only way you can relieve it is to try to move around. Look it up in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's been eradicated from the fifth edition, which has been purified. But look it up in the earlier editions, including the DSM-4-TR in the year 2000. And they'll tell you that tardive akathisia caused by neuroleptic antipsychotic drugs can lead to suicide, violence, psychosis, a general worsening of the condition. So these are not just movement disorders. These are disorders of the brain's basic functioning, including the frontal lobes, which can lead to limbic system, lead to enormous suffering. So we've got ordinary tardive dyskinesia, or classic TD, which involves hyperactive movements, movements that are out of control, taking any form you can imagine, slow, fast, snake-like, jerking-like. Then we have tardive dyskinesia, these horrible spasms, And then we have tardive akathisia, which is like being tortured to death. And you get some, but in very incomplete relief from moving about. And no real disorders from drugs. They're embedded in the harm done to the basal ganglia as well as the rest of the brain, including the frontal lobes. So these rates are just for those things. They don't include what goes along with it, which is the atrophy of the brain and the dementia. Many studies show that some degree of cognitive difficulty and dementia occurs in most patients who get tardive dyskinesia. Again, they try to ignore it in the higher halls of medicine and psychiatry. I tell you, it's a tragedy, it's a betrayal beyond imagination. Now, I'm going to jump to the antidepressants for a minute. See, the antidepressants are in many ways closely related to the antipsychotic drugs. They have some common ancestors chemically. We know more and more that the SSRIs in particular produce the similar indifference and apathy in patients. And even an apathy syndrome, as the textbooks call it for the SSRIs. Apathy syndrome. By the way, I have an unfinished new resource center on Bregan.com, which is the Antidepressant Resource Center. It doesn't have the explanations and the search mechanisms and everything that I've elaborated for the Antipsychotic Drug and Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center. And you'll find it lower down. You have to go down on the page a bit to additional resources to find it because it's just not finished yet. But you'll find a lot of that, this data I'm talking about there for the antidepressants. And the antidepressants, the SSRIs, which are supposed to be so selectively specific, that's what SSRI means, so selectively specific for hitting serotonin. Well, they also whack dopamine because they're rich interconnections between the raphe nuclei where the serotonin nerves come out of, which are deep in the brain stem and then go all over the brain, and the higher up basal ganglia where the dopamine nerves originate. So the whole notion of the selectivity of hitting serotonin is a drug company fabrication. So what happens through this indirect, which is pretty direct in the brain, impact on dopamine? Well, you can get tardive syndromes, permanent tardive dyskinesia syndromes, for unknown reasons, particularly the dystonias of the neck, shoulders, which are just horrible things to get. I mean, it tortures people. Imagine having a leg cramp in your neck for the rest of your life, folks. Imagine that. This is the kind of thing my colleagues are indifferent to. Don't yell and scream about and say, we got to find a way to stop this. I've had patients I've evaluated or worked with in legal cases who had such spasms of tardive dyskinesia in their necks, tardive dystonia, that in one case, an elderly lady was so locked down, her head was locked down into her chest. So that she went from a very healthy, active, smiling, engaging lady to somebody who couldn't lift her head, could only look out of the corner of her eye at people, and who couldn't stand by herself because of the pain and off balance, created such off balance for her. You don't realize how much you need your whole body to do routine things until one chunk of it locks down. Had another patient who got a huge tardive dyskinesia settlement, so huge it can't be talked about. And her tardive dyskinesia twisted her neck to her left, constant pain, at times banging her head back against a wall if she didn't stay aware, made it hard for her to conduct usual activities and to read or watch TV because of the head motions and then end up spasms. Tardive dystonia. So you get that from the antidepressants. Now you notice I said that the antidepressants, like the antipsychotics, cause indifference and apathy in people. Remember one young man, I think he was on Zoloft, who came to see me. He'd been on it for a few weeks, and he'd heard about me, and he thought maybe he'd come in to see me. He'd been depressed about some of the economic changes going on at the time. It was during a period of quite a bit of economic fear, and he was afraid of losing his job because some of his friends had at the plant. There's no reason to think he would lose his job. And besides, he could have gotten a job somewhere else. He's a very skilled and responsible man. And when I talked to him, he just seemed so unconcerned about anything except that localized anxiety about work. When I asked him about friends, he couldn't think of any. I asked him about activities he enjoyed. There weren't many, and so on and so forth. I thought, what a poor, isolated bachelor this is. Only interest in life is work. And since he'd only been on the drug a couple of weeks, literally, it was a very short time, I said, why don't we just stop it? We can do that. You're in close touch with me. Here's my cell phone. Let me see you in a week. He came back a week later, and because he'd only been on a couple of weeks, he was really free of all the drug effect as far as we could tell. And he was a different human being. He's talking about how he likes to fish and hunt. He's talking about his buddies he plays cards with. He's talking about his love of nature. All of that from a crummy 2 weeks on this neurotoxin. Well, all these psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins. They poison the brain. I mean, it's a fact. That's how we discover them. We find drugs that poison the brains of animals. We see it in their behavior. And then we say, well, that's a potential psychiatric drug. If we're a drug company working with psychiatrists. And we test it. That's how Prozac was found. That's how all the drugs were found, going back to the very first antipsychotic drugs. They were found to produce these abnormalities in animals, and so they were tried. Oh, boy, it's such a tragic story. Well, this young man, he got his life back. Now, imagine if he hadn't come to me. No other psychiatrist at that time in the United States, as far as I know, would have taken him off his drug. Now, maybe two or three would. None of them would have been thinking, my gosh, look at this dramatic change. The drug was poisoning his brain, ruining his frontal lobes. So I'm moving a little bit now from tardive dyskinesia, that essentially untreatable disorder. By the way, some patients do benefit from Botox, paralyzing a neck muscles or jaw muscles that are grinding and spasming. But it doesn't work for long. There are limits to Botox. You can tranquilize people with benzos, and that will help them a little bit. Doesn't last long, and it's addictive. There are no good treatments. People lose weight, they often do. They become extremely fatigued. They become ashamed of how they look. I mean, I'll just keep coming back to talking about some of these things perhaps during the rest of the hour. But this is what I'm learning more and more. And remember, this is spontaneous. This is off the top of my head, no notes, spontaneous discussion with you, and you can find a lot of this in my chapter on tardive dyskinesia in the Sedated Society. You can find it in my earlier chapters in my own books, in Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. You can find it in my second edition of Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. Oh, take a breath a minute. So what I'm now beginning to suggest to you is that despite what psychiatrists say and drug companies say, there's a lot of kinship between antipsychotic drugs and antidepressant drugs. So much so, my friends, so much so, that now patients are being given drugs like Seroquel and Abilify, the newest antipsychotic drugs, as well as some of the older ones, Zyprexa, Risperdal, the whole variety of them. They're being given these drugs and told they're antidepressants. They've been giving the antipsychotic drugs, we call them neuroleptics. That's what DeLay and Deniker call them, for grabbing the brain. So we're giving them antipsychotic drugs, calling them antidepressants. How did that happen? Well, they did some experiments. The FDA let some drug companies experiment on giving patients who really didn't have a good recovery from antidepressants an added boost with an antipsychotic drug. And some of them were better. Well, how does that occur? Because you're just flattening the poor soul even more. So the poor soul either doesn't complain to the doctor, doesn't say, oh, I'm depressed, doesn't care anymore. Psychiatric drugs are not caring drugs. First time I've said that on the air, I believe. It's part of a lot of my new thinking. All psychiatric drugs are non-caring, not caring, anti-caring drugs. What about the stimulants we give to children? Well, they got some relationships to the antipsychotics too. They too affect dopamine. They affect serotonin. So they affect the cholinergic system, which also many of the antipsychotics and antidepressants do. So there's a lot of sharing going on here between the amphetamines and which is all of the pretty much all the stimulant drugs, except for that new one that Eli Lilly puts out, the non-stimulant stimulant. So there's all these shared qualities. So how do the stimulants like Focalin and amphetamine and methamphetamine and Ritalin, how do these drugs impact on the brain? Well, if you look at animal studies, which, by the way, as far as I know, no researcher who's really involved in the field of ADHD and Ritalin has ever looked at, until I came along and started looking at the animal studies. One of the main characteristics of these drugs is to crush spontaneity, including emotional relationship. It's just another word for not caring that's evolved, crushing spontaneity, reducing spontaneity is what they say. So if you give Ritalin or amphetamine, Adderall, and so on, if you give it to a monkey, the monkey stops caring, doesn't want to explore as much anymore, doesn't want to visit with his neighbors, doesn't want to groom, doesn't want to kiss, doesn't want to participate in these adolescent-like hierarchical disputes that chimpanzees get in. It's another not caring drug. Now, if you look at lithium, that go to the mood stabilizers. We've covered the antipsychotic drugs, the antidepressant drugs, and very briefly, the stimulant drugs, which also can cause abnormal movements because they're impacting on some of the shared regions, especially the dopaminergic regions. They can cause permanent tics, commonly cause tics, and often they do become permanent. So little different kinds of impacts, not as gross abnormal impacts as the specific dopamine blocking, the specific dopamine blocking drugs. And if I've made a few slips here or there, folks, this is all spontaneous. I'm not looking at anything other than my instant messages with my wonderful engineer at the radio station, PRNFM.FM, to see if my guest ever got in touch. And they've just written me, nope. We kept trying, never found him. So listen, anybody in Great Britain, you see Jim Davies, say hi to him. Tell him we're doing fine. We'll have him on again. We'll have him on. Got an empty spot about 4 or 5 weeks down. We'll have him on. Meanwhile, we're going to keep having on his guests, starting with having on his chapter authors, starting with me. So again, I mean, you got this characteristic that all these psychiatric drugs, they're non-caring drugs. In the beginning, they may cause a little euphoria, some of them, and people feel better. But that's abnormal response. That's a neurological disorder. It's euphoria from brain dysfunction and damage. But then the euphoria hardly ever lasts unless the person goes into mania. This person goes into mania. Euphoria didn't last. And believe me, you don't want to go into mania. What happens with those three groups of drugs is you go into apathy, indifference, and not caring. And you feel that that's better than where you've been. And besides, as I've written in my concept of intoxication and anosognosia, you don't know what's happening to you. It's also, I call it informally, medication spellbinding. Drugs, whether you're drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana, strong psychoactive drugs completely confuse you about whether you're benefiting or what's happening to you. So people go into on psych drugs. I think this is the common denominator. This is for how it seems to work with people when they say it works, and also when their relatives say it works, or their doctors say it works. The patient's less expressive, less feelingful, less themselves. The not caring drugs. You listening to the show, this is the first time you've heard me talk about it in this manner. Some of my latest work, not yet published even. The not caring drugs. So now let's look at the mood stabilizers. Well, the big mood stabilizer is lithium. Lithium was discovered back in the late 30s, as I recall, because it flaked out guinea pigs. It wasn't, and since it was a natural product, drug companies couldn't figure out a way to make a ton of money on it. I mean, lithium was actually used in salt shakers as a substitute for salt, except it killed people. That was in the Journal of the American Medical Association decades before it became a harmless drug. It was killing people from salt shakers. Well, the originator, Cade, C-A-D-E, of the use of it psychiatrically, saw it flaked out guinea pigs. And so he gave it to them and saw that and said, wow, this is a great serendipitous discovery. I think I'll go across the street and give it to the patients in the state hospital, which he did, and flaked them out too. And he thought, wow, this is a great drug, especially for excitement, which is exactly what DeLay and Denniker and all the dozens of other psychiatrists were saying starting in about 1952, 53, 54, 55. We're saying about the antipsychotic drugs, especially good for excitement because they're flattening drugs. But then the industry caught up. And they talked to NIMH, and they got lithium approved for mania. And along with the National Institute of Mental Health, they held a press conference saying that we've now found a magic bullet. We finally have the psychiatric drug that's specific for a disease, for mania. Well, actually, what they had found was something that had long been known to be an extreme neurotoxin. Imagine extreme neurotoxin that kills people when they take too much out of their salt shaker, being specific, though, for mania. Nonsense. Any neurotoxin given enough will stop people from being manic on the way to eventually killing them if you go far enough. Lithium is so toxic, so horribly toxic, and so causes medication spellbinding that you have to check the blood of the people to see if they're getting into a toxic range, because the folks don't know what's happened to them on the drug. Now, inciting and showing how this drug didn't affect normal volunteers at all. Imagine that. A deadly neurotoxin has no effect on normal volunteers. They cited an article by some researchers. Well, I went looking for that article, and I talk about this in Brain Disabling Therapies. I went looking for that article. It was the only article at the time that I ever couldn't find in the National Library of Medicine. It was so obscure, and it was in a foreign language. So I wrote to the author of the article that was supposed to show that normal volunteers didn't respond, didn't have any negative effects to this drug. And I said, can you just give me an English translation of your article? Well, this is so long ago, they didn't know who I was. They just knew I was a young psychiatrist, in fact, affiliated with the Washington School of Psychiatry in Washington, D.C., who just wanted to know a little bit about lithium and researching it. So they sent it me their translation. And it turned out that a small number, 3 or 4, I can't remember the exact number, of researchers all decided to take the drug. And every one of them had drastic effects. It muted them. It was like a dark glass between them and other people. It slowed down their thinking. They weren't able or interested in doing complex games like chess or whatever they were playing. One of them even said daddy was nicer now because daddy didn't, I guess, lose his temper or get so irritable. He was muted. So that's the kind of lying and deceit that goes on, that NIMH cites this article, and that author was actually citing the article in his writings as having no important effects on volunteers, when it changed their personalities and muted them. So in every class of drug, psychiatric drug, that we can study enough, the antipsychotic drugs as a model, then the antidepressant drugs, the stimulant drugs, the mood stabilizers. Now, the benzos are pretty easy because they're like alcohol. They affect similar neurotransmitter systems. The GABA system, whose effect when jacked up is to put you to sleep and into a state of where you can do surgery on you, anesthesia. Most anesthetics are closely related to the benzos. Now, the receptors for the benzos are not on any one system. The receptors are on all the nerve systems throughout the brain. In fact, unlike other drugs, Unlike other neurotransmitter systems, GABA has receptors lining the axons, not just in the synapses, lining the axons. This is a really heavy-duty control system. So when a benzo makes you feel better because you don't feel so anxious, it's just like feeling better and feeling less anxious if you take a drink or two of alcohol. You are cutting off your higher mental and emotional functioning. And if your goal is to feel less anxious, then you will feel better, because that's how you'll identify. You'll say, yeah, man, I don't feel as much anxiety. You won't think about the fact maybe that you don't feel as loving, or that you're not as quick, or that you better watch your tongue, or you'll say something stupid, or you might get too aggressive. You're not going to think about all that. And I think about that's when you get vicious towards your dog your kids or your husband or wife, what you'll think is, it sedates me and I feel better, cuts the anxiety. So taking benzos is very little difference from taking alcohol, except it's much more insidious, tends not to cause such acute cerebellar defects that you're slurring and staggering. That comes a little later, but the benzos can have quite a mental effect before you start slurring and staggering. So all drugs impair the highest functions of the brain, all the psychiatric drugs, and all neurotoxins, which psychiatric drugs are. And in that process, probably the single most important thing they do to us is they make us not care. Now, and then if you're taking care of us and we've been very difficult on a hospital ward or at home, if we've been a royal pain in the neck, and we stop caring, we're a lot easier to take care of. So these drugs are your not caring drugs. That's how I'm talking about them right now. Now, this discussion began with tardive dyskinesia, damage to the basal ganglia causing tardive dyskinesia, causing lethargic encephalitis, the psychiatric drugs, the first big drugs causing lethargic encephalitis. Well, folks, we're drawing to an end. I hear the music. I've had a wonderful time just talking away with you. I rarely do that. And it's the first time, maybe the second time, I've done it totally without preparation, sharing with you some of the latest stuff on my mind. I hope it's been enlightening and interesting to you. And I just want to thank you, the most wonderful audience on the air, the most enlightened and caring. Not uncaring, like the drugs make people, but the most caring audience in the world. Thank you very much. This is Peter Bregan saying bye for now.